We're thrilled to be in the studio with Yvette Theory, the executive director of Safe Streets, New Orleans' native daughter, and a longtime activist and organizer. Welcome, Yvette.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
So let's start off with your work at Safe Streets. How long have you been the executive director, and what kind of work does Safe Streets do?
I've been the director since about 2010, but I've been a member since 2006.
Okay, and what are the issues that Safe Streets work focuses on?
Well, we work criminal justice reform. We work with police accountability. We had a recreation equity campaign that talks about when kids does not have access to parks and playgrounds and green spaces, that this is another way that our kids get caught up in the criminal justice system when they are denied access to affordable recreation.
Mm-hmm. That's real. And so since before I get to talking about Katrina, since the anniversary is coming, I thought we would kind of take someone who's been doing the work and looking at the landscape, seeing how it's changed since before and after. But what drew you to working on issues of, you know, the criminal issues within the criminal justice system here in New Orleans?
Well, after Hurricane Katrina, I had a loved one that had a mental problem, and our mental, we had no mental infrastructure after Hurricane Katrina. And I guess because a lot of us were just traumatized from the storm and not realizing that our lives were ever changing, Katrina and Rita really changed our life as we once knew it before we evacuated. And coming back and trying to rebuild and just, you know, go on with our lives, you know, you kind of use the resources that you used to use before the storm, but we didn't realize that that infrastructure had just crumbled. Mm. And so my brother-in-law, who had been having some mental challenges for a while, would go in and out. He had been off his meds, of course, because of the evacuation, lack of medical access and stuff. So his mother did what she always did, went to the coroner's office, got a commitment paper, and they would usually come and take him to the hospital. And then, you know, a couple of days back on his meds, he stabilized, come home. Well, in May 2006, when she tried to use the same process she had used before the storm, it ended up with the New Orleans Police Department / Task Force ending his life. And I think being part of, you know, watching that process unfold and all the untruths that was told at dreadful night, that at the end of the day, you know, for him to lose his life senseless, all he was guilty of was being a mentally ill, challenged person that needed some medical attention, which we didn't have at the time. And I guess we didn't realize how bad it was until that happened.
Since you started talking about the mental health infrastructure, and that's something that I'm really concerned about here, because in a city that has so much trauma, there isn't, like you were just saying, there isn't a mental health infrastructure afterward to take care of these people. But however, you know, there's the criminal aspect. What if you know, did the mental health infrastructure look like before Katrina? What kind of services were available?
There were a lot of service. You had Charity Hospital, and I like to always say, you know, like our mentally challenged people always knew when they were tired of, you know, being on the streets or whatever, they knew where home was. They knew where third floor of Charity was. But after the storm, there is no more Charity. They shut it down. So our mentally ill people are even more confused because they don't know where to go to even access, you know, their medication. Even recently, I have a cousin, you know, that has been going, you know, in and out. Which she was a professional. She taught school for well over 30 years. But even during that time, to go to show you how things are different now than before the storm, because she was able to still maintain, and she was a special ed teacher, and whenever she got sick, you know, we called her doctor. Her doctor brought, you know, maybe had her in for a couple of days, got her stabilized, and she was able to go back and teach her class. But just recently, Mother's Day, called the crisis unit. They were, you know, they came in and say, well, yeah, she needs to go to the hospital, but never once told a family that they were going to send NOPD to escort her to the hospital, which was very upsetting and traumatizing for me, being that I witnessed another mentally ill loved one be killed. And so it was my fear, you know, and I said to the crisis team, why did you not tell us? Because I don't do police. Because had they told me, I would have taken my chances with her son, trying to put her in a car and taking her to the hospital myself. But, you know, that just show you how our mentally ill are disrespected. And when you look at it, they even look at them in a criminal aspect. Because if you think, you know, to bring someone outside of their home in handcuffs in front of their neighbors, so what would that leave for the neighbors to think that she did something criminal because she was in handcuffs? Not the fact, you know, if they didn't know her history, that she was only being brought, you know, for medical attention. And that just really disturbs me to see that our mental health system has gotten to the point where we have to criminalize our loved ones who have challenges to get help. That it just really does, it just makes me sick.
Yeah, and that's one of the it seems like that's another population that's feeding the boom or maintaining kind of the numbers, even though there's
right
in the prisons too.
When you talk about the school of prison pipeline, we have a mental health pipeline as well. Mm-hmm. If you're mentally disturbed and you get, you know, the only way you can get treatment is to be brought to jail. And I think that's doing such a disservice to our loved ones, because they don't deserve that. I mean, jail is for when you violate the law. Mm-hmm. They didn't violate any law. They just, you know, happened to be somebody that needs a little more love and care than what, you know, us normally other sicknesses that we may endure in life.
Right. And then the treatment that they're going to get, especially in a place like OPP, isn't going to be good treatment.
Right. And just recently, my cousin was had to be taken to the hospital a second time since Mother's Day. And she was allowed to sign herself out, which there have always been a law, 72 hours that you can sign yourself out. But normally before the storm, even though that policy was there, for some reason the doctors cared enough to find a way to override that policy. But that's not the case now. So now, you know, they will let you sign yourself out at 72 hours. Doesn't matter that if you're going to go home yourself, home your loved one. Like, you know, no one is really, you know, really looking to after our mentally ill people in this city. Mm-hmm. It's just sad.
And where is, like, the closest mental health facility to us? Like, maybe long-term 24-hour care?
Well, I think the...
That's specifically for mentally ill. That's not a prison. That's not...
Right. So there's Tulane has a facility, and there's a one, I think, on Jeff Davis. But it's, you know, I talked to them on Mother's Day about that, her accessing that particular facility. But it's a short term, like, you know, they, from what they assess her as being, like, she wasn't a good fit. Mm. Because they only, usually when you're admitted there, that's like 2-3 weeks tops. And, you know, when they assess her, they was like, well, we don't know if she would be, you know, a good candidate. So she was taken to, it's called the LSU Medical Center, mm-hmm. The old DePaul. And in the middle of the night, we got a phone call that she had been rushed to the hospital because evidently they weren't giving her the proper medication. So they overdosed her to the point where she went into like a stroke. Mm. You know, so the mental health, it's just really crazy in this city. You know, in the post-Katrina, when so many of us are still walking around here traumatized. Yeah. 9 years later, I think we all have a level of where we could have some real therapy. You know.
I mean, it's amazing all the ways in which people sought a profit, but nobody found some way to profit off of people's mental health, I guess. I guess it's more profitable to lock folks up and build, you know, big jails and charter schools. Speaking of charter schools, now that...
So, yeah, like, I think they have, you know, since Katrina, even though Orleans Parish School Board definitely had its problems before the storm, but I think when they came up with the master plan, which I just... recently attended a Bessie Board meeting, and so one of the former Bessie Board members, Luella Givens, who was ousted out by Kira Ernst Jones, who is a young 30-something-year-old from New York, who was backed by the governor and the governor of Louisiana, and it was this, I think he's the mayor of New York, and so it was like, what does the mayor of New York has connection to New Orleans? Mm-hmm. And so you will have to wonder, why was this young lady, you know, African-American, looked like us, but why was she, you know, such a favorite over Luella Givens, who is a native of New Orleans, very seasoned, but here you're going to put this young lady who just freshly almost came out of college over infrastructure of a school system that has been torn apart. Like, I don't understand, what does she bring to the table other than to keep a, to keep the tearing the schools into, like, these mini pieces, charters here, charter there, and there is no accountability what comes with charter, because every charter has its own board. So, you know, you can go to the board, but it's not likely that you're going to get anything done or hold anybody accountable, because whatever their decisions is, that's what it is. And so RSD, which is Recovery School District, it almost remind me of some post-Katrina stuff when NOPD was so corrupted. And so I see that corruption in the Recovery School District. They are thugs. They are really, really thugs. You know, the master plan has been amended so many times that even the members of the Bessie Board was looking confused, because the paper, the
Can you tell what the, say what the master plan is, just so folks can...
So the master plan is everything that's supposed to be governing our school system in New Orleans. And as our former council member would say, it's the rule, the law. It's law. But everything in this master plan is like thousands and thousands of pages. So it's so hard for people. And then when they implemented, they gave us less than a month to go through thousands and thousands of documents. So, you know, nobody could, you know, really dive into it and just see what was driving this, what was driving that. So to bring up Joan McDonald, which is the school was closed at 2014. So Coach Frank, who's been doing a lot of advocacy around education, and just, you know, because so many of our seasoned teachers were fired to bring in young Teach for America teachers who's not very culturally, you know, they give them a couple of weeks of culture training and just put them into these community schools, which, as people will always say, New Orleans is very diverse, which is true. Because, you know, two blocks can have this culture, two blocks to the left, two blocks to the right, and you can find two different cultures going on. So this master plan has really, really, has really caused a lot of havoc for how we, you know, have rebuilt our lives, because everything, every law that they do, every gentrification that's happening in our communities is based on this master plan. And so John McDonald, the master plan said that John McDonald would be chartered. It did, but it failed. Then they said 2014, John McDonald was to be closed and given back to the Orleans Parish School Board. But Doug Patrick Dobar, RSD Recovery School District, wants to spend something like $49 million of FEMA dollars before he turns it back over to Orleans Parish School Board, which is insane, because if the master plan is just y'all playing, that says 2014 is shed and you turn it back over to Orleans Parish School Board, then that $49 million need to go to Orleans Parish School Board. And then they saying that for other use. So there was a merger of O'Perry Walker High School in L.B. Landry, which is my alumni, which is 75 years old. It was named after a black doctor, Lloyd Beaconfield Landry. And they merged O'Perry Walker, which was named after a Caucasian superintendent, you know, which those schools are very close in proximity, but they definitely carry two different cultures. Like, myself, I'm like four generations of L.B. Landry alumni. I have one of my kids that is an O'Perry Walker alumni. So, you know, they took and they shut O'Perry Walker down and just took over Landry. So they put O'Perry Walker name / Landry Walker, which I found out from looking at the master plan. They have shifted an elementary school into a high school building, but that would only be for this school year, because after this school year, they're probably going to shut O'Perry Walker down and it's spared to be land banked. And when it's going to, when they land bank it, I can promise you that Delgado, which is next door, will be the one who will absorb that school to grow the community college. But yet further down the road, you have an elementary school that you turned into a high school, which everybody think is insane, because you can see a high school going to elementary, but how do you transform an elementary school into a high school, which happens to be under Elgin's charter? So you see all the confusion that keeps happening with our school system, and yet we asked them not to merge those two schools, but not listening to the community. That school, now that it has been merged, nobody from the neighborhood goes to Landry. These kids come from uptown, downtown, New Orleans, east. So you mix in all these cultures. And you know what has happened that they don't report? There are six kids pending second-degree murder charges. There have been 4 to 5 kids that have been murdered behind going to a school outside of their community. This is what the master plan has done to our communities.
Were you involved in school things before Katrina, or could you speak a little bit about the changes that have happened or what it was like before?
Well, not really. Well, I have grandkids, and I've always been involved, and I'm still involved very much in my grandkids' lives. But before the storm, I lived in Jefferson Parish. And so, you know, coming back after Katrina, out, you know, because of, you know, limited living arrangements, I was forced to come back into Orleans Parish, and my grandkids came back from Lafayette to attend school. It was so horrible. It was a RSD, Recovery School District School. The principal was so horrible that when I would come to the school, she would tell a security guard to watch me. And I'm only there trying to make sure that my grandkids are getting what's due them, a good education. If they're not being in compliance, I'm going there to talk to, because, you know, as a parent who raised two kids in a public school system, whenever one of my kids act out, I was always there able to go talk to the teacher, and we would make a plan how to get that child back focused. But that wasn't happening. Like, you didn't get past the principal's office. Mm-hmm. They would not let you talk with the teachers. So, you know, that was a way of not being able to talk to the teacher with the student to find out where the problem was. How can you support? And so I just found that as a problem. And so that's when I started advocating not only for my own grandkids, but for other kids. And then we start hearing, you know, all the suspension. Kids was being suspended for coming to school without a belt on, without the wrong shoes. So I feel like our focus has been about what our kids wear opposed to what they're learning. And that continues to be a problem in our school system in the post-Katrina era, that we're more worrying about what kids do far as their appearance rather than are they getting books, because a lot of times there's no books. A lot of times kids are not coming home with homework, so you will have not a clue as a parent what your kids are getting inside the school if they're not you know, sending, because homework is just an enforcement of what you're supposed to have taught that day in your classroom. But if you're not bringing me no homework, I have no idea what you taught my child that day.
I guess another question I have about that, just to be clear, so there's charter schools, there's the RSD, and how many schools do they run, or what is the situation with that now?
So what RSD is doing is like, RSD is like the, you can look at them as Wall Street. You know, a lot of stuff gets shifted and sold on Wall Street. So this is what RSD, Recovery School District, actually there was an Act 35 that's mandated RSD was only supposed to mandate the schools for 5 years. Well, now they went back and amended, probably in some back room, that's, you know, their best practice in this city. And they asked for 2 more years because all of this FEMA dollars was starting to come down the pipeline. And so you had Paul Vallis and Paul Pastrick, who I really believe has stole a lot of money, but they've, you know, that's what's been going on. People, you know, they steal the money and they go out, they leave. So now you have Pastor Dumbo, who's a St. Aug graduate, and Dana Peterson, you know, two African-American men. And I'm sure when some indictments come down, they'll go to jail while the two white guys just get the, you know, a free pass. And that's just unfortunate. But when you will not stand up and let the truth be told, then you get what you need, you deserve.
Speaking about backroom deals and government officials, how do you feel about what's going on with Ray Nagin and him getting?
Well, I think it's, you know, just looking at the African-American elected officials, it's almost like a setup. And no matter how educated they are, they don't get 101, and that's just simple. And this is why they keep finding themselves indicted and going to jail. Ray Nagin did a lot of good, but he did a lot of bad, too. And I think the whole thing with Ray Nagin, he was more of a businessman, and he ran the city like business instead of what's, you know, what's right for the people. And I think that's why he ended up not. I don't think he should have gotten 10 years because you have police that murdered people on top of the Danziger Bridge, and none of them got a murder charge. So the justice is very twisted in this city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of justice, so what did you think about the sheriff's race that happened in earlier this year?
Well, with the sheriff race, it was like you really didn't have a choice. You either went for Charles Foti, who ran a real prison with 7,000 beds. Or you voted for Marlon Gusman, who has a violent jail. So it's like, you know, you had the lesser of the two evils.
I couldn't tell which one was.
So you didn't really have a whole lot to choose from, and a lot of our elections are coming down to the lesser of the two evils, and you know, and I think this is why people are just so checked out on the voting deal, because they feel like no matter who they go in and vote for, there is still no accountability. And you know, people just don't trust the political process anymore.
Right. I saw today that in the paper that Mary Landrieu has been endorsed by the Sheriff's Association. What do you think that means? What do you think the implications are?
Well, usually, and this is some of why I think, you know, poor communities are just losing hope, because if you have money, then you have persuasion. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one would think the Sheriff Association, because that's their business, is to make money off of people in jail. Mm-hmm. So when you would look at that, you know, you would think, oh, well, they must have gonna get some kind of favor with her. Mm-hmm. And it's usually that's just how it, you know, it is. Your constituents is who put money into your campaign. It's not about who you represent. It's who controls you through the campaign process.
Yeah. What do you know her record to be thus far on kind of criminal justice issues.
I don't know that Mary has a real record as it relates to criminal justice issues, because if she did, I figure we would have a little, our reform would be moving a little quicker than, you know, it's always about the community pushing. Just like with the Department of Justice, with the consent decree for the police department. Our mayor take credit, but it was a coalition of many people, which my organization was involved. We did a people's consent decree. We marched on Camp Street. We sent a letter to Eric Holden at the Department of Justice, and shortly thereafter, and see, this is what the mayor don't know. We were hosting community meetings all over the city. And at the time, somebody from Department of Justice came to one of the community meetings that was in Holly Grove. And so we had been talking about racial profiling. And it was an African-American person from DOJ, and his assistant was white. And they were in
which consent decree are you talking about? I just realized this.
The NOPD consent decree.
Okay, just so folks know.
This is with the police consent decree. We were just trying to collect stories of people who had had, you know, bad experiences with the police. So we were going from different neighborhoods across the city, especially poor communities, just, you know, getting people to tell their stories. So finally, when we got the ear of the Department of Justice, they sent somebody down to one of the meetings, and they were racial profiled. They wouldn't publicly admit it, but we know that it happened, and that's what's important.
How have you felt about the way the consent decree has been handled since it's been passed down?
With the police consent decree, what is bothering me is what happened to Shamar Allen. And a number of arrests that the state troopers have made, it just make me feel, as somebody who's doing criminal justice reform, that I feel like that's just over the top with the arrests. So that, you know, I have concern as to what the federal monitor's going to do, how you regulate the troopers that's coming in here. We under consent decree, you watching NOPD, but who's watching them? Should they not have to follow the same, you know, guidelines that the police have to? I would think they would, because this is a federal mandate. And so we should be regulating them, which I heard on the news today that they won't turn over the footage because they don't. There is some undercover. Well, if there were state troopers, what did undercovers have to do with it? With them being in this in this situation, and so I feel like this is not gonna be a good outcome for us, because they can be able to taint tapes. Like we're not crazy. We know with technology you can make it look however you want it to look. So I would say don't touch it. I mean, if you gotta blow their cover, oh well.
We're talking with Yvette Theory, the executive director of Safe Streets. We are going to take just a quick break and read some announcements, and then we'll be back. And I have a feeling that she has some words on the OPP consent decree, nonprofits, and various other things happening throughout the city. Stay tuned. You're listening to WTUL New Orleans 91.5 FM. Ever wonder what song you just heard on WTUL? Our DJs post our set lists online on Twitter and Radioactivity, where information about songs, artists, and albums are available, organized by date and time. Curious listeners can also view all playlists by one WTUL DJ online. More information can be found at wtul.radioactivity.fm and at twitter.com/WTUL_playlist.
blanca renace mi pueblo de Roque Pérez. Llamas de aquellos fogones que aún viven en mi mente, abriendo paso y dejando ser camino simplemente, cabalgando en el silencio.
Okay, so we are back in the studio with Yvette Theory, the executive director of Safe Streets and New Orleans' own Native Daughter. We were just talking about the NOPD consent decree. What were the, you're talking about groups going around, what were some of the conditions that were going on to cause folks to band together in coalition and say, we gotta write a letter to Eric Holder, we gotta do something about the police in this city?
I think the biggest thing was the racial profiling, and a lot of times people were being stopped. They were drugs was being planted on them. There were a lot of illegal searches of people's property.
Go ahead.
So I think once the police stopped you and ran your name and saw that you may have had a previous conviction, that made you ripe for whatever they felt like the moment was.
So with like things like the police planting drugs on folks, were folks able to get out? Was that something that was able to be proven that was happening? Because I've heard those stories too, but I just wonder, were any police held accountable for that behavior?
Not really. I think some of them got caught, not for everything that they had done, mm-hmm. like Flat Top, that was his street name, Melvin Williams. This was before the storm that he had shot someone. And I guess because of the storm, it kind of held up his trial. And so, but what was crazy about it, while people were steady complaining on Melvin Williams, I can remember my very first Safe Street meeting at the Sixth Baptist Church in I guess they call it the Garden District. well, I'm going to say the St. Thomas, former St. Thomas Project area. And so he saw us congregate in the community. And so he was trying to intimidate, like, what are y'all doing? Da, 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 da. But James Carter, who was on the city council at the time, had been invited to the meeting. And so he witnessed him trying to bully the community, you know, about gathering, trying to have a Safe Streets meeting. And so a lot of people inside our membership had experienced, you know, their kids or whatever being harassed by this police, taken to jail. Some of our members themselves had been victims of his harassment. And what was amazing, I think before this consent decree came down, the more brutal you was to the community, the higher up you went in rank. Like, they would award you for being, you know, a knucklehead. And Melvin Williams had gotten some kind of award while under indictment, you know, under investigation. So that was crazy, you know, to think, why would you award somebody that's being investigated? And so he ended up being convicted. And since Katrina, we've had well over 20, 21 and counting officers that have been indicted. But the thing about it, the indictments on the Danziger Bridge, nobody was indicted for actually killing anybody. It was for covering up, you know, falsifying reports. And so that's unfortunate, because everyday community people, when we shoot somebody, we get murder charges. Mm-hmm. And so that's just kind of, you know, just how we just know that these reforms are not as good as we would want them to be, but we have to still fight toward that happening.
Right, and it shows the double standard of how the law is applied. One of the many double standards, shall we say, the multiple standards, where we know that, you know, black and brown people are usually at the receiving end of the harsher treatment, and that cops who, with all this training they're supposed to have, they're supposed to be protecting life, right, and mm-hmm. and serving for the
well, we noticed after the storm, before the storm, the officers used to have a badge that said to protect and serve. They don't have that no more, because they know they ain't protecting nobody, and they sure not serving us. Yeah, mm-hmm. they serving us with a ride straight to the jail.
Mm-hmm. So this perfect time to go right into the OPP consent decree. So how did that come about? How did that get that process get started? Was it similar to the NOPD consent decree?
Yes, it was a coalition of concerned citizen, Orleans Parish Reform Coalition, which had been around really since 2002. And the former Warren Riley, who was the superintendent, was part of that that coalition as well. But it rebirthed after the storm, you know, because of all of the bad conditions inside of the jail. And, you know, people were steady being arrested. And you know, you would hear stories about 20 people in a 10-man cell. You know, and I just couldn't wrap my head around that. Like, if it's for 10 people, how you put 10 extra? Like, what does that look like? That mm-hmm. means you were caging people, and you had to be violent because somebody was fighting for something. You know, it was just an inhumane situation. And then you had a lot of people being harmed inside. I remember we went to Social Farm in 2007, and at the time, one of our members, Miss Rosetta James, her son OD'd in there. Never got a phone call from the sheriff. Mm. It was another inmate calling their family member to get message to her. Mm. And I still don't think to this day that lady has ever got a formal apology or a written report from the sheriff's office to say, this is what happened to your son.
And we know that it's still currently, you know, a violent, dangerous place for people to go, and they're still allowing people to go in there. I personally think it's a human rights crisis, and the city is moving way too slow at it.
And I think as it relates to poor people, that's always the response, slow. And I think really, I am very just disappointed in the whole process, because what I was hoping that the Department of Justice would do was padlock that whole jail and move everybody out there, because even the pictures you mm-hmm. get to see on TV is horrible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let's be real. We know that the response to poor people, that the response to poor people's issues and trauma and when they're in crisis is to keep them in that perpetual state of trauma and crisis and emergency, so that they can continue to be poor and serve the interests and basically keep the rich propped up and keep the tourist industry, those jobs.
Because mm-hmm. really, what they're bringing in the state troopers is not about communities. They're not in the community. They're downtown in the French Quarters.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's one thing that I've noticed about this city is how obvious it is. So I like to call it blankery when I'm not on the radio.
It's, you know, Louisiana itself, I think, is just, you know, based on a whole lot of corruption, and poor people just can't get justice because they don't have access to, number one, the type of representation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, you know, would represent, but they're afraid of the powers that be, because they, you know, they don't want to get blackballed in certain situations. That's even down with our nonprofits that has popped up over since Katrina. A lot of these nonprofits is nothing but pimps. Mm-hmm. They write these beautiful proposals. They do these beautiful grants. And some of the funders themselves are even, you know, they even guilty, because when they come here and to see what they've done with their money, first thing they want to do is go to the French Quarters and eat and drink. And they don't even understand that that's a lot of our problem right there, because there is so much gentrification going on because the French Quarter is overpopulated. So now they're starting to gentrify certain communities to expand the French Quarters because of the tourist, you know, industry. And you know, they part of, you know, keeping them happy. And so that relates to the crime that you see. You know, yeah, it's a lot of young people, And I'm not condoning what they're doing, but what people need to know is because their communities has been gentrified, they have been pushed out, they have been disrespected, and what you see is nothing but retaliation because they don't know how to organize themselves against the powers that be. And it's unfortunate that the people that they're robbing and busting in the head, it's not their fault either. It's the people who pushed you out. Mm-hmm. If you can go find some of the developers, some of the people that killed the activity in your community, that's who need to be busting the head, not the people that's coming here and taking part in buying these homes. They only just buying them because they're available and they have the resources too. But this is what's going on in this city, why, you know, you have this NOLA for life that's mm-hmm. a NOLA for joke.
Yeah. I appreciate that you said that about gentrification too, because exactly, those are the real gentrifiers, the developers, the people that are making master plans. Those are the folks looking for a little mobility and just looking for a place to call home. They're, you know, it's really hard to move in a way in this world, and especially in this country, where you're really conscious and you know that by you moving in, you could be helping destroy a neighborhood. And that's so, I really appreciate you bringing that up, because it really, gentrification is really about racial and economic apartheid, and those people that actually control how people can be moved around and shifted, and how neighborhoods can be divested from. But it's not my interview, so.
Could you speak a little bit about what it's been like trying to organize in these kinds of communities at this time?
Especially with all the nonprofit invasion.
Right, and so it is hard because, you know, like, what I have come to realize that all the carpetbaggers have been here since Katrina have set themselves in key positions as in foundations, in nonprofits. So they suck us dry. So, you know, the only time they want to come talk to my organization is when they could use my stories of my people. But yet and still, they are the ones getting all the funding. And so that's when I say, you know, there is no measurable. I don't think these funders really want ask for measurable outcomes. Because, see, when you come here, you shouldn't be coming to the French Quarters to get a good plate of food. And so you need to be asking these people who you're giving your money to bring you to those communities that, mm-hmm. that you fund them to do the work, you know. And sometimes you should make surprise visits. Because don't give them time, because they'll find people to come put a little party together because they figure, you know, that's what you want. Mm-hmm. But these funders, you know, they fund people who have name recognition in this city. When they need something, they go to them like they're the only person who know anything. Mm-hmm. And it's just really, really ridiculous.
Could you give some more examples of that? Like, how does that tie into what you're talking about, NOLA for joke or these kinds?
Right, and so our mayor is very controlling, and he has set up this NOLA for life. So all these nonprofits get to beg him for money. This mm-hmm. nonprofit is not. Mm-hmm. Because what I'm teaching my people is that you can sustain your own organization. Safe Streets hasn't had funding in over 2 years, but we still here and we're not going anywhere. Because what I'm teaching in my leadership development is that you can sacrifice a meal, a fast food meal, and put it into your organization so that you can have meeting space and have what you need. But a lot of, you know, Katrina, a lot of money was thrown in this city, just oodles of money that was misappropriated. And there is still, you know, some of the bigger, largers, like your Catholic charities and stuff like that, that people and your Red Crosses and stuff, that, you know, get lots of money. Mm-hmm. But they part of the problem, too. Mm-hmm. Because you may give them millions of dollars, but then they give the community 25 at a time. Mm-hmm. In the name of a gift card or you know, some groceries or whatever, but that is not sustaining people. Mm-hmm. Instead of giving them fish, you should show them how to fish. And a lot of these nonprofits are not interested in that because they're number one threat, and they're not going to give their people that kind of leadership development because they want to always stay at the top to make people feel like they need them.
Right, right. Exactly, because these nonprofits that are often led by some of these carpetbaggers you were talking mm-hmm. about, if the people are really developed as leaders, then they would take over that leadership and just be right. controlling the change that's in their communities, right?
Exactly.
Instead of these people that have degrees, that get to write these beautiful proposals and
mm-hmm.
All that good stuff. So I've been doing this thing where I'm not really asking you questions because you've just started jumping in really well. So now I don't have a question.
Well, I guess, we could just speak a little bit of what Safe Streets is working on now.
So we're kind of been in conversation with some of the educators about how we show this, you know, this education piece as a criminalization piece. Because so Patrick Thug Dunbar, RSD Recovery School District, did a presentation at the Bessie Board meeting, which this board is made up of different parish people from different parishes. So what was interesting that he projected so many elementary schools that would be built or be up online. There were more elementary schools to be opened in high schools. So he said something where there will be less than 50,000 not needed high school seats. So you do the math. Where are these kids? Are they going to be dropping out of school? I don't think so. Hmm. When you look at the age of kids that's committing crimes, most of, by the time between 8th and 9th grade, those kids are either dead or they are already facing some serious charge in the criminal justice system. So I think what we want to do now is kind of focus on that and try to get parents more involved and get them to see that there is a plan, that master plan, where they don't even, you know, they build jails based on 4th grade test scores.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's deeper than that because they've already said that your child won't go past 9th grade. They would not need those seats in high school because they don't plan on your kids being in those seats.
Two questions. I wanted to kind of go back to government politics. Because there's a new city council, kind of mostly new,
mm-hmm.
and then there are the judges' elections coming up. So what do you think about working with the city council?
You know, they always build these illusions for us, I find. That's just my opinion. You have a basically 5 African-American city council. And so that's supposed to make African Americans, no. I'm not feeling that because I'm looking at my own city council person that I'm not very happy with, and I work hard to put her in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's breaking my heart that I may have to work hard to make sure she don't get back there a second term. So I think, you know, we get so caught up in who look like us, and we don't think enough about who think like us.
Mm.
And I think that's the illusion that they keep building in this city. It's like, you got 5 African American, but if they're not looking at the interests of the community and doing what's right for the community, then it doesn't matter to me what color you are. You just ain't no good. Patrick Dunbar is African American. I don't have no faith in him.
Mm.
Nadine Ramsey is my representative in my district. Mm-hmm. I ain't feeling her right now. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's not about if you get elected as an African-American. It's about what you do when you get there. Do you have some thought process about what's humanly right?
What would you like to see some of these folks like? So you're not as happy with Nadine. What would you like to see her doing that she's not doing?
I would like to see them represent the whole district
mm-hmm.
and not the, it, you know, it seems as though Nadine is following the same footsteps as her previous. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a lady robbed at 4 o'clock in the evening at the Winn-Dixie in my neighborhood. She didn't get outraged and say, I want to know how many police was on staff that day. You put in all of these TJ Maxx and Ross's and all this here. But what is that going to do for my community? I live like one block over from all of these new businesses. So you impacting my community with crime because it's going to spill over from those entities. And right now, the Walgreens is 24 hours, but the police doesn't come on till dark. So who's mandating, who's protecting my community in the daytime when everything that happened in the night happens in the day?
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, you know, thinking because we know that police don't necessarily provide safety or security either.
No.
And in fact can remove because both
really,
of those things from the situation.
I caution people all the time about being so 911 happy. Because this is what the experience has been in the black community. You call the police because your house been broken into. First thing they want to do is see your ID, and they got to run your name to see if you got an outstanding warrant for some traffic, something or another. Because 9 out of 10 times, it is the case.
So you've been speaking a lot about a lot of the issues that you see, and I'm just curious if you had just a little bit of visioning of what you would like to see, you know, in your ideal community, right?
In my ideal community, I would love to, the people in those communities should be leading a lot of their own process. They should be able to say what they want in their communities and what they don't want in their communities. It should not be led up to these politicians because, as you know, everybody make a joke, they're just a pile of tricks. And so I would like to see how the people have more representation because too many decisions be made for the community without the community. And usually they'll come to us with a fake meeting after decisions has been made. But if I think you should have to have community at some of these tables. Because people do care. And I think until that happens, we're going to keep a level of people not relying in the electoral process. You know, if it's not a president election. And like I tell people, let's be clear, we did not put Obama back in office. We did not. We're a Republican state. And so all the miseducation that happens, you know, in the communities and people thinking. And I think we have to change the mindset. Like, we have to start impacting stuff on a local level and then move up to the state level. You know, like, we have to learn what our processes is and what could we do. One thing I would love to see our council district expand. I would love to make us, you know, like the research has shown that when you have more council represent, some people call them commission or whatever. I think it's too competitive the way our council is set up now. Because like in District C, we are part of the French Quarters. If you cut the French Quarters out and had your own representation in Algiers, I think our community would fare much, much, much better and let the French Quarters have their own representation.
And what about, like, for schools and for medical and mental health?
We need to go back to local control. Because most of these people sitting on these charter boards are carpetbaggers. And they don't have a clue what our community needs. Because every community needs is different. And we need to open back up some men. Let's be clear. If you did a poll, we probably don't have, we're not even half, back to half of our psychiatrists that we had before the storm. You know, the psychiatrists are being overwhelmed. This is why our mental health patients are not getting the treatment that they should because there is not enough. So I think we, you know, our politicians or the powers that be should be outreaching, trying to make it more that doctors want to. Because before the storm, I was working at East Jefferson, and I know we had some very, very good doctors there. And we lost some of them after the storm, and they didn't return. And that was the same thing with the mental facilities. That's why they had to shut them down, is because they really didn't have the staff to to even keep them open.
All right, we have it's just about an hour, almost time for Democracy Now. Is there any last things that you want to leave us with? Any last sentiment about the state of New Orleans?
Well, I'm hopeful that we are going to make some change in here, but change only happens when you become the change that you want to see. And so, you know, to the listening audience, I just say get involved. Find some way to do something that you're passionate about and make a difference.
And how could folks get involved with you in Safe Streets if they wanted to?
Well, we have a number, 522-3949. That's our Safe Street number. We have our community meetings every fourth Wednesday at the Hope House, 916 St. Andrews.
All right. Well, we're in a real interesting moment in history, and it's going to take bold leadership like yours to move us to someplace better. So thank you for all the work that you're doing. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank y'all for having me. Yeah,
yes,
thank you.
We appreciate you. Yvette Theory, welcome anytime.
All right.
Para adentro, las luces malas del centro te hicieron meter en la pata. Nada te importó, ingrata, echaste todo a rodar, o es tu afán de figurar. Enfermo tu alma de olvido, y ahora hasta tenés marido las cosas que hay que aguantar.